That was good.
Thank you.
Not that good. Good. It was kind of. We're looking at his views. The last thing we were talking about was he distinguished from the visible and the invisible church. And I hope you're seeing that this thinking, don't understand John Calvin, you're not going to understand modern Protestant denominationalism, modern belief-only Protestantism, as I sometimes call it. Well, very important. Well, look at, in contrast to Luther, Calvin set out on organizing a state church along the New Testament pattern. He didn't get very far. Why? He couldn't. Because he started with the wrong thesis. We've already talked about that. We need to know his views in the relation of the church to the state. It was the role of the state to protect the church, punish heresy, that is, if you got a heretic, you call the sheriff, while leaving the church to govern its own affairs.
I'm noticing that somebody changed a lot of number on me.
Okay.
Are you all finished? Yes. Thank you. May I proceed now?
Yes.
With your permission. I won't interrupt you. Oh, this is cordial. I always like to ask. There was to be no control by the state, as opposed to Luther's view after the Bundschuh or the Peasant Revolt. Luther felt that the state ought to step in and govern the church if it had to. Get it back in line. There was to be no control by the state of the church, and the state was not to control the church, the state was to protect the church and leave the church alone, according to Calvin. As a matter of fact, the church in Geneva remained under the control of the town council, as a matter of fact. The state and the church were to work together to build this theocratic society of the elect. Well, so much for that. I've said enough about that. We come to works. Where do works fit into this? Works became evidence of election. Whereas Calvin, the Roman Catholic priest, taught salvation by works, de facto, Calvin, the reformer, taught that works are evidence of election. Now, this is very important. It was this that made the reform movement more evangelistic and produced a more dynamic society. That is, you see, who is the elect? Well, just that, the ones that God chooses unconditionally. But once a person if he is in the elect, God saves him, or God regenerates him. Miraculous regeneration, infused grace. You simply must know these concepts. Then it follows that if a man has been regenerated by this definition, that he will serve God. So works are evidence of election. And the Calvinist, a German scholar, Max Weber, spelled Weber in English, is famous for his what's called Weber's thesis, or the Weber's thesis, and that is that the Calvinistic work ethic is responsible for modern industrialism, modern capitalism. Now think about this. You see, and now there was that thesis has been since discounted, but there's still some truth in it. Although not exclusively. For instance, two countries that really led out in the Industrial Revolution, England and Austria, were not really Calvinistic. Not early on. Austria was Roman Catholic, very strongly Roman Catholic. But you see, it did produce a different view of work. I'm going to teach you this, okay? So tune in, it's very important. It's worth all the money you pay for this course. Question. Why does a man work? Well, does he work just to survive? Or is work itself an act of righteousness? Is work a virtue or just a grim necessity? Now, I would point out, to show you how our thinking is affected, that you recognize especially if you were raised in the Midwest, or with Midwestern kind of thinking, that a man who, Paul says, a man won't work by meat, that you recognize, don't you, the modern aristocracy of the working man. That is, if a man's a working man, he's proud of it. Right?
the working man. You listen to country and western music. Like they glorify the working man. When I was in the local ministry, I always wanted to be a working man. They never considered me a working man. I wish I could have been a working man. I could have made twice the money in half the hours if I'd been a working man, but I was supposed to be a working man, so I... By that they mean manual labor. Understand? The working man means manual labor. Working with your hands, what manual labor means. Manus is Latin for hands. Now, and so, if you work with your hands, you are considered, that is a virtue. A man who will not work is lazy. He is not virtuous. As a matter of fact, John D. Rockefeller, who had all this money, made his kids work anyway. Made his kids earn everything they got. Why? Because of the virtue of work. And our society, I would point out, looks down upon the rich kid who spends his whole life on vacation because his daddy's got a big bus, right? We look down on that person. And the fella who gets out of high school and has to work his way through college and, you know, or gets out and gets a job and provides for his, he is looked up to. But you must, that's how our society works. You must understand that for most of the world, for most of its history, it was reversed. That is, to work with your hands was considered a shame. Still is in much of the world. The ideal is the life of genteel leisure. A tuxedo, formal dress, evening dress is sometimes called, includes white gloves. Army officers wear white gloves. Where do we get that? Where do we get the white gloves ethic? What's the significance of white gloves? We may have covered this in early Christian centuries and another. No, something else. Would you keep John quiet back there? The idea, gentlemen, European aristocracy used to wear white gloves because it's for the same reason that the Mandarin of China let their fingernails grow real long. To visible evidence that we do not work with our hands. White gloves. Officers wear white gloves because they give the orders, they do not do the manual labor. Unless the man does the manual labor. Understand that? So that if you work with your hands, it was considered a shame. The ideal was the person didn't have to work. And that's why in the French Revolution, when the communists reversed it for their own reasons, when the guillotine was its most active in the French Revolution, they were in the Tale of Two Cities, that drama, Madame Lafarge, you know, and she knits and the names. If they wanted to know who they hung, they just looked at their hands. If they didn't have calluses, they hung them. Why? Well, you see, you're not among the proletariat, the working class. You're the parasite on society. How'd this get reversed? For instance, you go to, where does capitalism come from? What is capital? What capital is cash that's left over after your basic necessities have been met. What does that mean? You've got your shelter, got your food, got your clothing, paid your insurance, got everything paid for that you have to pay for. If you've got anything left over, what do? You put it in the bank, get interest for it. Somebody will come to the bank and borrow that and invest it in industrial equipment, and tools, and machinery, and you've got, in other words, to have industry, you have to have capital. Because if you don't have capital, nobody can ever accumulate enough money by borrowing or financing anyway to build a $10 million factory where people can work. You understand? You have to have capital. Capital is what's left over when you've earned. You go to Egypt today, an example of a country, much of it sort of backward. A man, it's the way it's been in most history of the world. A man worked until he had what he had to have, and he quit. For instance, a week he'd be a regular shop. This man would go to the Middle East, in the Orient, man would go to the shop, he'd sell pottery, or he sold, and he'd open his shop, and when he sold enough, that before he had to have that day, he'd close up. The business friends, you'll be rich.
Women.
included. Women, well, women wore these fabulous dresses. One of the very, you know, you see these look in that 17th, 18th centuries. I didn't think that was the style of huge dresses. And women in the South Wales, did you see this latest series on TV? Not in South Wales, it was. Terrible series. Anyway, show these women, you know. But that was part of the significance of that was you can't do any work in dresses, clothes like that. You cannot work in those dresses. The slave women wore the shifts, you know, the clothes, it's called the shift, which is, you can work in that, you know, the knees and work. Those dresses, part of the ethic, the ethos of that was to show that I don't work. So I can't work this huge, you know, 16 petticoats and 2 boots. Well, now, so. Now, it is true to a measure that John Calvin changed this. Why? Because he viewed work, all kinds of activity, godly activity, upright activity, such as not just Christian service, we would call it, but simply man doing his job. He considered this a virtue. It was evidence of election. And since it was evidence of election, Calvinists were anxious to work. So that you do not work. Why do you, now, I mean, before I continue, is this making sense to you? Before I continue, I point out that the Jews were the exception to this. The Jews, more that they were a complete exception. Remember Paul says that that's something that a man work with your own hands, this may not be in need. The Jews stressed that every young man had to have a trade to work. But work, and so work was higher, work was more highly regarded among the Jews than among the non-Jews. But even you would find a young man of a well-to-do family who even the Jewish ethic was not the modern ethic. So, then the question, so Calvin said, why does a man work? He works because it demonstrates he's a child of God. He works because it's right, which means a number of things. So you get the combination, this is what Weber said, Max Weber, or Weber, the German scholar said, and like I said, there's an element of truth in it, but it's too simplistic, and that's this. You get what happens to a man who believes that it is his duty to God, has nothing to do with his need, to have 3 meals a day and have a place to live. It's his duty to God to work, okay, hard. Number two, to work as efficiently as possible. And number three, not to spend his money on riotous living as the prodigal son did. What happens in the case of that man? He gets rich. And be frugal and not waste it on fancy living, he is going to accumulate capital. All other things may need it, not every man. But that's the tendency. Y'all see that? So, that is, whereas the man in the East, when he's working, he opens his shop up at 9 o'clock and by and one and he closes it at 1 o'clock to take a nap, and then he opens again at 5 o'clock when the heat of the day is over, and by 6:30 he's sold enough that he can get by another day. He's got other things to do. He closes his shop and goes and sits and does whatever he wants to do. The man in the West, after Calvin, especially in non-Catholic countries, he will work, he'll open his shop, keep it open, and close it at the appointed time, no matter whether you're earning or not. Now, that's, by the way, this is part of the explanation why Roman Catholic countries tend not to be economically prosperous. If you look at Europe, what are the industrialized prosperous countries in Europe? The Latinized, the thoroughly Roman, remember we talk about the Latinized parts of the South? What do you find? Well, industrialism is late or non-existent. Northern Italy has been industrialized. This has been since the Second World War. Go to Spain, what do you see? Portugal, Mexico, Central and South America, industrialism has come late or not at all. What's the Latin? Typical stereotype? This is a stereotype of the. What's the stereotype of a Mexican? It's unfair, but the stereotype. Yeah, he's sitting under it. He's sitting under it. Under a tree or next to a cactus, the serape and his over his shoulder, his hat over his eyes, sombrero, asleep. And if he says, if somebody says to him, we must work, we must get something done, he says, mañana. Like there's even a song from out in the 40s. Mañana, mañana, mañana is good enough for me. The window roof is leaking, the rain is coming in, if I try to fix it, I'll be soaked into my skin. But then the sun will come out and the rain will go away. And who needs a rain? Point is, it stands for it. There's enough truth in it. It is suggestive. As opposed to the Yankee, the New England Yankee, frugal, or the Scots. What's the Scotsman? What's the Scotsman? You're a type, frugal Scotsman. It's Calvinist. Gets up early, works hard, saves his money, does it today, efficient. You see the difference? Well, Calvinism produced a great deal of that by simply shifting the view of work. That work, instead of being a shame or a grim necessity, work becomes a virtue. Y'all see that? Neither a shame nor a grim necessity, but a virtue. And we still think that way, most of us. I was raised that way. I come to the hills, Southern Indiana, and the old people were old when I was young. They had their view of people, and a man didn't have to be educated, didn't have to be rich. But if he did three things, if he wouldn't do these three things, he was what they call sorry. In other words, he's sorry. He wouldn't keep himself clean. If he wouldn't keep his word, and if he wouldn't work, he was sorry. He might be poor as a church mouse, and uneducated, but if he was clean and kept his word, you believe him, and he would work. He was respected in the community. He might live in a two-room house, on the dirt floor. He was respected in the community. Okay, now, can you not see how this would promote capitalism? Be back to what I said before. What countries became really industrialized? England led it. But it was at a time when Calvinism, the evangelical movement we're going to study later, became on strong. And of course, America. It's hard for us to think any other way. We're getting back to the welfare state is putting us back into the old pagan ethic. You see, I can remember when the welfare first started, back in the days of Roosevelt, I was a little boy, and we didn't get warmed up until the 50s and 60s. It was a shame to be on welfare. I can remember when I was going to school, this is awful, I was a little guy and I didn't have any sense of righteousness about it then, but there were always kids who were the welfare kids. They got the free lunch, and everybody went on their own welfare. And we felt sorry for them in the demo. So I'm ashamed of that now, but that's what I made me think about then. And so a man, when he came in on welfare, it was designed to be a temporary thing. But the welfare system was designed to If I take the time, if I take the job, the time I pay my taxes,
And what it costs me to get back and forth to work, I'll make less than I do on welfare. No, otherwise, not myself. I make $8 more. I figured it out. I make $8 more a week. I took the job. Then I get for no other. I said, who's going to work for $8 a week? And my answer is, anybody who has any self-respect. See? But when people lose their self-respect, we're back in this thing. You understand what I'm saying? This is why the welfare system progresses, because And we think that way. For instance, a student in this school has to work, take a part-time job or even a full-time job to get through. He's not looking at money. We respect him. And it doesn't mean that we don't respect the person who doesn't have to work. We don't despise them, but it's not a shame to have to work. Well, because of Calvin. Okay, any questions on that? Yes.
You said that work was viewed as evidence of election.
Okay. Evidence of election.
Does that mean like secular work?
Yeah, any kind. That's a good question. Remember I said not just Christian, what we would call Christian service, church work, but all work. Because Calvin was a great, see, Calvin said, now listen to me, this is Calvin. If a man is preaching the gospel, say he's a preacher. Why is he a preacher? He's because God destined him for that. Everything is predetermined. Man B, he's a farmer. He gets out and gets his hands dirty every day. Why is he doing that? Because that's where God put him. God, so that the man who's an aristocratic gentleman or the clergyman, they cannot boast in being in a higher station in life. Why? Not really, because God put them there. So that, since it's all appointed by God, all predetermined by God, that the farmer is just as respectable at his level as the clergyman. Therefore, God has called him to do what he's done, just like God called the clergyman to do what he is doing. You all see that? So all work. I'm not saying they remove classes. There was a stratification of society. But for this reason, it embraced everything, all work. Good work. And you certainly see this, in America, we call this the Puritan ethic. Now, the Puritan ethic today is if somebody says, well, you're a Puritan, that's like calling you a Pharisee. In our modern society of moral freedom, it's considered the work ethic is under attack. And anytime anybody wants to put an idea down, somebody says Puritanism. Well, the Puritans had a lot going for them. They built our country. Our country started from one thing. That's the part of the Puritan ethic. That when a man got up in the morning and hitched up his horses and went out to the hay fields, he was serving God. And he had a responsibility to work honestly, to work hard, to keep his word. You work because you're sorry if you don't. And if you don't need it, if you don't need the money, you work anyway. And you give it to other people, see? And you give it away. You give it to the church, or you help the poor. Or you put it in the bank and save it. Understand? If you don't, that's what you do, or you're sorry. I'll tell you, we could do with a lot less sorriness in our society today, couldn't we? Anyway. You know the thing that brings more ministries than any other single thing? It's not immorality. It's not lack of exegetical skills. The thing that ruins more preachers than any single thing is simple laziness. Okay? Not that a guy can't. I know good preachers, you know, good moral men, they just fail because they won't get out and work. I understand that. I don't know, I don't minister here recently in the state. Lost his ministry, had no reason to do it. Everybody liked him. Good preacher. He knew what he was doing. He's just lazy. He finally couldn't take it anymore. Why? You get men in the church, they got up, put in their 40 hours a week, and they'd get up and go to work. He'd get up 11 o'clock and go fishing.
two or three times a week, you know. Or just mess around. And they didn't understand that. Well, I don't understand it. Well, if you won't work. I'm very serious about that. A lot of preachers are just lazy. And yet many of them, and some yet the hardest working men I've ever known are good preachers. I'll don't mind naming names on this side. I'll tell you a fellow who's a good example. The former president of our trustees, Long Days, who's over Zephyr Hills. When I first came to Florida, I went to Zephyr Hills, and that was just a little handful of people, sorry little bunch, didn't amount to head of means. And then they hired Lauren Days over there. And Lauren's, you know, he's not a highly gifted man, he's a good solid man. And last time I was there, they ran close to 400. Chairs set up all the way back, gonna have to build again. And you know why? He gets 50 calls a week. He's done the people respect him. He's a worker. He gets up and in the morning and does and works. And everybody knows it. And people will support a man like that. One of the reasons preachers often don't get much response when they ask like in the congregation to work is that they know he's not working. You get a man like that, they'll follow him. Just good, follow me. No fancy. You look at his program, no fancy program. Good, solid program. You know, just a good, basic, solid preacher. But a lot of fellows who had better programs have failed. Not him. Boy, I respect him. He's a worker. And he's known. We got a problem with our preacher. Why? We're afraid he's going to work himself to death. We'd like to keep him for a while. First time I heard that in a long time. I'm usually the other way around. And I respect a man like that. You know, just good old-fashioned, hard work. And he could get by with doing half what he does, or less. Most preachers in the state do. But not him. I hold him up to you as an example. Well, anyway, that's my sermon to you on the word. I can't stand people who are lazy. I'm an heir of the Protestant ethic, the Puritan ethic. Well, that's why, by the way, you ever notice that when I teach, I've never said this before in class, I'll just say it here, and the word gets around. I often have students that are struggling in my courses. And if I know they're struggling, I never go to them and say, can I help you? Why? Because they don't care enough to come to me and say, look, I'm struggling, but I'll give it my best. Love to fail. A student will come to me and say, look, I don't think I'm making it, you know, and what can I do? Is there any work I can do? I want to apply myself. I'll help them. I'll do anything I can. But if they're lazy, they're just not going to apply themselves. Forget it. I don't want to do the ministry anyway. And a student will work. I'll go the second mile, and the third mile, and the fourth mile sometime. The student is working. They're trying. If a student is lazy, they want sympathy. They need to go to somebody a little. Calvinism is not simply a theology, it was a theory that touched every aspect of life, public, private, social, not like Lutheranism. Listen to me. Here, Lutheranism, the state, the eternal dichotomy, the state and the church. Luther said they operate in separate spheres. Okay? Calvin said, no, it's all one. It's all one. That was a major difference between Lutheranism and Calvinism. Now, so Lutheranism would not touch a lot of subjects like poor peasants after the moon shoot. Not Calvin. Calvinism was concerned with everything you did, no matter where you did it. He aimed at a mature theocracy. When he first came to Geneva, remember Farrell started the work there and then brought him in? Calvin was on his way somewhere else and Farrell said, well, God, you remember Farrell's one that would walk into the when the mass is being said, strike the host to the ground,
preach this is not the body of Christ. Well, Pharaoh pronounced a curse of God on Calvin if he didn't help him there in Geneva, so Calvin did play there. He wasn't sure Pharaoh was right, but he couldn't be sure, so he stayed as God's. Big brother, you know that? He was, if somebody acted up, he was barred from the Lord's Supper until he repented. It's like that. Somebody, you know, every quarter, someone on your block watching your spiritual life. You went to the theater, you were heard telling a dirty joke or singing a worldly song. You cheated on a business deal, then report you to the town council, to the church, and you'd be censured. As for instruction, he worked out a catechism, as Luther had done, wrote a book called Instruction in Faith, drew up a creed, had a law passed that anybody had to accept it or leave the city. That's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Clear cut. As far as worship, he rejected all church, we've already talked something about it, rejected all church festivals, including Easter and Christmas. Remember, Zwingli kept a lot of things in the church year. Luther kept just about everything. Luther only took out of the calendar the church year only that which was openly pagan and superstitious. Zwingli cut it down to what he considered a Calvin cleaned it out all the way down to Christmas and Easter. He could never get the council to accept every Sunday observed for the Lord's Supper. He wanted Lord's Supper every Sunday as opposed to Zwingli. He wanted every Sunday. He instituted a system whereby church leaders would examine the member and issue a ticket. This came into the Reformed tradition. Keep in mind, the Presbyterian Church is the main heir of the Calvin, the main direct heir of Calvinism. And in Geneva, they started this thing that before you came to the Lord's table, it had been examined by the church, the relief from the elders of the church, and you were given a ticket. And when you came to the table, they'd present that ticket to show you and the examiner were worthy to come to the table. This is continued. One of the great moments we're going to see next quarter in Alexander Campbell's life was in Edinburgh, Scotland. He comes to the table, and he puts his ticket on the table and walks out. That's when he broke the Presbyterianism, just before he came to America. It was all the way back to Geneva. Calvin permitted psalm singing only, no musical instruments. Talk about this. He permitted free prayer along with liturgical prayer. What's free prayer? Calvin, the city council, could not agree on the particulars of worship. Calvin resisted the efforts of the council to control public worship. The council said, we're going to control it. So he and Pharaoh left Geneva and went to Strasbourg. And the council banned him for 3 years. Calvin did not have a sweet time in Geneva. For 3 years, they couldn't even come back to the city. Because what it was a power struggle. Who was going to control things? By things, I mean everything. Society and the church, the city and the church. The town council or the church, or Calvin. And the first round was won by the town council, understand? They banned Pharaoh. While he was at Strasbourg, he was invited by Martin Bucer to become the pastor of a small congregation in Strasbourg, and these were Calvin's happiest days. The little church there, he was happy as a clam. He brought out a second, he had time to write, he brought out a second edition of the Institutes. There's some other things you can read there. He wrote a commentary on Romans, which you got all wrong. He married, had a child, both his wife and child died. Calvin had a rough life of it. Some say his gloomy theology reflects his gloomy life. That's really true. He was hated about everywhere he went. Strasbourg was the exception. His wife died, his child died, he had kidney stones. Some of his theology reads like it was written by a man with kidney stones. They make you mean, and kidney stones are good. And he was sick most of his life. Other things, miserable life of it. Well, he comes back to Geneva. His enemies on the city council were voted out and asked him to return. Why? Because to set the church in order. He did so and spent the rest of his life in Geneva. But many of his enemies got back on the council after he came back, and they had trouble, gave him trouble for years. He resumed his program of discipline at Geneva, and I put this paragraph in to really give you a picture and see how you would like it. Now keep in mind, this is the first time for much of these are the basis of what most of them are not in the books anymore, but America has a tradition of what are called blue laws. You've heard of blue laws? Which really, like a law against swearing, for instance, a law against opening the store on Sunday, a law against selling liquor on Sunday. These are considered blue laws. I'm not sure why, but that name came from. I don't know, but I don't. Okay, people did not conform to the standard of righteousness under the threat of disbarment from the Lord's table. The town council was to step in and exact a civil punishment, have them beaten, fined, or banished, imprisoned. Laws were passed against dancing, gambling, card playing, theater going. The theater was basically raucous and pornographic. And it's like, much like it is today. Frequentation of taverns. That is, you could drink, everybody drank, but you could not get drunk. Profanity is against the law to swear. Do you realize that many laws on the books? I bet you in some cities, even in Florida, there are still on the books laws against profanity. I know there are, they don't enforce. They're all, Luxury. These are Calvinists. This is that is why. Well, you don't spend. For the woman had too many dresses, too fancy dresses, wore too much jewelry. If a man spent too much on his clothes, had too many horses. Excesses at public entertainments, that is, you get carried away, like people do at the beach and things. Gluttony, I like that, ate too much. That'd sure kill us on a weekend, wouldn't it? At a church social. Immodesty in dress, licentiousness, irreligious songs. And by the way, the medieval world was full of this stuff. Dirty songs, dirty jokes, it's a way of life. And that, I'm saying, is a real problem. All of which were punished by censors, fines, or imprisonment. Censors, where they call you up on the carpet and blow you out. The number of dishes to be served at a meal was regulated. Why? Well, you don't have too many. It's unnecessary. It's fancy. It's simple. Children could not be named after Roman Catholic saints. Interestingly enough, you see this. Calvin preferred Bible names. And I don't know if you like the interest of this or not, but this reflects, this is in our culture. If you go to a Roman Catholic country, what's everybody named? Jesus, which is Jesus. Juan, which is what? Pedro, which is this is Central Mexico. Pedro, which is what?
Peter.
Mateo, which is? And half the women are named Maria, or Mary. Named after the Roman Catholic. Well, the idea is if you get named for one of the saints, then they'll give you special attention. And often, if the common thing is, so, and Europe did that. Now, but then the non-biblical saints, Calvin forbade that, and he suggested the biblical names. Of course, some of the saints' names are biblical as well. But so people, so they still use John and Peter, the biblical names. But then they would go for, and that's why you see this tradition. You read the name, personal names of the Puritans. You got Isaacs, Jethro's, Zacharias. You ever seen that? Read some of these people. So they began to. There was a change in this custom of taking names. Where am I? Attendance at worship was required under penalty of fine. Got that? You didn't go to church. We had a nice crowd in those days. You didn't go to church, it cost you a fine. Spies were everywhere. Homes were checked once a year by the elders of the church. Husbands could beat their wives, but they could not rub salt or vinegar in their wounds. You can see how lax they were. Before, a man. man would beat his wife and rub salt and vinegar in the wound, but they said, no, that's not inhuman. You beat your wife. But you can't rub salt or vinegar in her wounds.
Those were the days.
Now that, are you talking about ruining a good thing? I mean, let's finish this then we'll quit for the day. Men were banished for jokes. Didn't have to be a dirty joke. Banished. Women for dancing, put out of the city for a year or two. A 12-year-old girl was publicly beaten with rods for saying she wanted to be a Roman Catholic. That'll teach you. Listen to this. Three men who laughed during a sermon were put in prison for 3 days. A laugh, by the way, today, in most of our churches, it's considered not considered out of line to have laughter in the church, but back in those days, it was. And some of the older people, the old Catholic tradition, still think it's unholy to have laugh in church for any reason. The three men, 3 days. A girl was beheaded for striking her parents. Kids minded in Geneva. Men and women were burned for witchcraft, which is very ugly. A man was sent to prison for years of solitary confinement because he called Calvin a baboon. Moral of this story is, do not talk about your preacher. Was that unusual? No. The last thing I'd point out here, this kind of thing was not unusual in Reformed cities. You must judge Calvin in light of his times. And there was a great need for discipline in the society. They were fighting a terribly chaotic, moral and chaotic society. We're going to start moving faster now. We've got to. Have a good weekend. How'd y'all do on the exam? Were those good numbers that came out of your
head? No.
No?
Number wasn't a good number. I got very upset when I noticed number 7 out
there. This Miss Woodbury said she had done it. This baby, the Prince of Peace, this baby had no earthly father. Mary, who taught this doctrine, didn't believe a word of it. She declared the son illegitimate, which it was. And there was a big flap in the church over that. It was in this year that she adopted the title Mother. She had disinherited her adopted son and never raised her only son, but she was Mother. 1907, the total number of Christian Scientists was 50,000. 710 branch churches, 50 divisions, foreign companies, you can read the rest of that. 1910, Mary Baker Eddy died. Her followers believed, many of them, that she would rise, she would conquer death. So far as I know, she hasn't. Today, Christian Science is in serious decline. Most of its members, as I say, are middle-aged and elderly women in the more affluent areas of the United States. If you go into a Christian Science bookstore, that's who you find there. Middle-aged and older. Women, upper middle class, probably wealthy women. That's about all the Christian Science is made up of now. Membership peaked out about 300,000 in the mid-1930s. That's pretty good number, a chunk of people in the 30s. Now it's less than 200,000, and branch churches, as branches of Mother Church in Boston, which is the headquarters, and reading rooms are being closed down every year, so it's on the decline. Every year there's fewer members and fewer churches and fewer reading rooms. Let's take our break and then we'll talk about the distinctive doctrines.